Greetings and salutations, Darklings. We are Chell and Tori. Welcome to Vampires Ruined My Life.
Tonight, we're going to discuss the 1979 film Nosferatu the Vampire.
Nosferatu the Vampire is a 1979 stylistic homage to the original Nosferatu from 1922, which is a retelling of Dracula. Unlike its 1922 predecessor, though, writer-director Werner Herzog was able to use the names of the original characters as the Dracula book had entered the public domain in 1962. Nosferatu the Vampire was written, directed, and produced by Werner Herzog, the famous filmmaker who made over 60 films and documentaries, including The Wild Blue Yonder and more recently, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, a black comedy crime drama starring Nicolas Cage, who recently played Dracula in Renfield. You also might recognize Herzog from his role in The Mandalorian as the client who sought the galaxy for the child on behalf of his imperial superior, Moff Gideon. Herzog is one of the founding members of New German Cinema, a period in German cinema which lasted from 1962 to 1982, in which a new generation of directors emerged who, working with low budgets and influenced by the French New Wave and Italian neorealism, gained notice by producing a number of small motion pictures that caught the attention of art house audiences. Nosferatu the Vampire is notably one of these films.
Awesome.
Nosferatu the Vampire stars Klaus Kinski as Count Dracula. A volatile, violent, and intensely mentally unwell man, Klaus Kinski appeared in over 130 roles on film during his lifetime. His most notable work was with Werner Herzog, who also made a documentary about his friendship with Klaus Kinski entitled My Best Friend. Isabelle Adjani as Lucy Harker. A French actor of German and Algerian descent, Isabelle Adjani is the only performer to win 5 César Awards for acting, all in the Best Actress category. She was made a Knight of the Legion of Honor in 2010 and a Commander of the Order of Arts and Letters in 2014.
Yeah, she was very good in this, I thought.
Very good. And then we have Roland Topor as Renfield. He was a French illustrator, cartoonist, comics artist, painter, novelist, playwright, film and TV writer, filmmaker, and actor, who was known for the surreal nature of his work. Roland and his family spent his early childhood years hiding from the Nazis, and after the Parisian landlady of their apartment tipped off the Gestapo, Roland was placed with a French family given a false name and the identity of a Catholic schoolboy. After the war, of which Roland's family survived, Roland's family successfully sued their former landlady into returning their belongings and letting them move back into the building. Good for them.
Yeah, remember, no kidding, kids. That's great.
Yes. Remember, kids, only you can prevent the rise of fascism. Do your part and punch a Nazi.
Hell yeah.
Filming Nosferatu the Vampire was tricky because Herzog wished to use the same locations as the 1922 film by F.W. Murnau. However, the real Wismar, Germany, was located in East Germany during this time, and Herzog had to find a dupe in another port city. He turned to Delft, Netherlands, and was able to shoot some of the film there despite tension from the denizens who lived through Nazi occupation and weren't really too pleased with a German film crew hanging out in their city. Authorities shut down the production altogether when they learned that Herzog wanted to release 11,000 rats.
Ooh. And again, don't blame them. That would be unpleasant. Yeah. And I would not want that in my city either.
So Herzog picked up and they went to Stichtum, also in the Netherlands. The Transylvanian government flat out refused to have anything to do with another Dracula-related production. So a castle in the then named Czechoslovakia was used for Dracula's Eastern European abode. And I found this very interesting. But so in the opening sequence, we see very obviously, I think, a handheld camera slowly panning through these dank catacombs. And this sequence was actually filmed by Herzog alone at the Mummies of Guanajuato Museum in Guanajuato, Mexico, where a large number of naturally mummified bodies of the victims of an 1833 cholera epidemic are on public display. He took the corpses out of the glass cases that they were normally stored in, propped them up against the wall to film them, arranging them in a sequence running roughly from childhood all the way through to old age. I thought that was very interesting.
It is. That's really creepy. And it's kind of just funny picturing him like pulling these poor bodies out of these cases and being like, okay, we're going to.
And like, it didn't specify, but I'm like, I'm sure he did this with permission. I'm sure he did.
I would hope so.
Yeah. He's not like,
but there's now a big sign that says, do not touch the mummies.
Do not take mummies out of the glass case and film them. We're looking at you, Werner Herzog. So, I'm sure he did. He had like a lot of proper permissions. Yeah. But also noteworthy is that the crew and cast, like for the bulk of the shoot, there were a couple of on locations that the government required him to have more crew. But it was a bit of a skeleton crew. It was only about 20 crew members, at least like while filming in the Netherlands. And the cast is maybe 30 people tops, even including the uncredited roles. So we're looking at a cast and crew total of less than 70 people.
Wow. Very small production.
Very small production.
So here's a short summary of the movie. In this retelling of Dracula, Jonathan Harker is an estate agent sent by his employer, Herr Renfield, to Transylvania to help Count Dracula purchase a property in Wismar. He makes a long journey despite his wife Lucy's misgiving. On the way, he stops at a village near the pass where he's warned not to go to the castle, given a book about vampires, and finds that no one will give him passage there by carriage or other means. No one will lend him a horse. He actually talks to this guy and the guy's like, oh, I don't have a carriage.
I don't have a carriage as he's like literally petting his horse drawn carriage.
He's like, there
okay,
is
I'll
no
take
pass.
A horse then. And he goes, I have no horses. Exactly. And I was like, I like this guy.
And it was very funny, but clearly he is not going to help him. So he is kind of on his own, ends up walking. At the castle, Dracula is a little strange, but he provides Jonathan with a meal. And he's like, oh, you know, I never eat at this hour, but please, please eat food. He seems less than interested in the property floor plans that Jonathan has brought. And then when Jonathan cuts his finger accidentally, Dracula sucks on the cut, saying it's an old remedy. But this spooks Jonathan, and he ends up backing away from the Count, and the Count kind of like bears down on him as he's backing away. And they end up sitting in front of the fireplace, and Jonathan eventually falls asleep. When he wakes up, the castle is kind of strange. It's, you know, a little bit in disrepair. Windows are blown out. Stuff is kind of messy. He goes up into the room that he was supposedly given, I guess, to stay in and, you know, pulls out a diary. He's unable to write letters because there's no post up here. So he decides to write a diary for Lucy to kind of tell her what's going on. And I guess he'll share it with her when he gets home. Dracula sees Jonathan's locket of Lucy and is very taken by her, it seems, and immediately signs a contract to purchase the property. He's even like, we haven't discussed the price. And Dracula's like, you know, I'll pay any price. I'm sure you'll give me a fair price or whatever, which, by the way, is not the way to buy real estate. That night, as Dracula feeds on Jonathan, Lucy simultaneously has foreboding nightmares and wakes an alarm, crying out her husband's name, which startles Dracula as he has heard it across the miles. He leaves Jonathan, who eventually discovers the Count asleep in a coffin, confirming for him that Dracula is indeed a vampire. That night, Dracula leaves for Wismar, taking coffins filled with the cursed earth that he needs, and he actually stows away in one of the coffins as well. The coffins are loaded onto a ship, and throughout the journey, the ship encounters mysterious deaths and the disappearances of crew members, and there are rats everywhere. In Wismar, Renfield has been institutionalized and says cryptic things. Lucy feels something bad has happened to Jonathan, who finally arrives home, but is gravely ill and seems to have some kind of amnesia and doesn't even know who she is. The ship carrying Dracula drifts into the canal, and the captain is tied to the helm. Hundreds of rats abandon the ship as the harbor master and custom officials search for any survivors, of which there are none. And then a plague soon hits the city, killing a huge swath of the city's population, including the city council and all the cops. So I guess maybe the plague isn't all that bad.
Ha!
Dr. Van Helsing is called to look after Jonathan, who rules out the plague, but isn't sure what ails him. He's feverish, and like I said, he doesn't even know who Lucy is, so he's very out of it. Lucy finds his journal and the book about vampires and manages to piece it together. The book helpfully tells her that one way to stop the vampire is if a woman of pure intentions makes him forget the crow of the cock, the light of the sun will destroy him. Mina, Lucy's sister-in-law, is among those killed, and she realizes that Dracula will kill everyone. Determined to stop him, when he comes to feed on her, she keeps him there, holding his hand and getting him to keep drinking from her until the sun rises and he dies. Unfortunately, so does she. Van Helsing, who has finally realized that Lucy was right, stakes Dracula to ensure that he won't rise again. Jonathan, meanwhile, has become a vampire. He gets Van Helsing arrested for the murder of Dracula because Van Helsing walks down the stairs with a bloody stake, as he has just staked him, and it does not look good. And then he demands that Lucy's room be sealed off as a quote-unquote crime scene. He's last seen riding away from Wismar on a horse. That is the end of the movie.
So overall, what did you think of the film? Was this your first time watching it?
It was, yeah. I don't think I'd ever seen it before.
Okay. So yeah, I'm very curious what, since I'm the one that, yeah, picked this.
Yeah, no, I really liked it. I thought it was really good. I don't know what I was expecting. It wasn't exactly what I expected because I guess I knew it was kind of a Dracula adaptation, but I don't know. It was just different than I expected, but I thought it was really well done. It was really interesting. The Count is super creepy and just very awkward, kind of, which I thought was interesting. Like, he's not scary he is scary, but I feel like a lot of he's just very inhuman and odd. And the way he does things is very, like, he's not good at hiding what he is in any way. He is not good at cloaking that he is something other, which I thought was interesting. And I thought the way the story progressed was really neat, too. And I really liked Lucy in this. I thought it was well done the way they adapted her story.
That's the perfect segue, actually. Let's go ahead and talk about Lucy as a character, because, yeah, she is the reason why I love this film so, so much.
Yeah, she's really good. And she has a lot of agency in this version, which I don't see in a lot of Dracula adaptations. I feel like often she's the one who dies first, possibly because of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Correct.
But I feel like she's always the one who's just kind of one and done. And then it's Mina who tends to take over. And instead, Lucy basically drives this whole story.
Right. I mean, and even if this was, I mean, she's obviously taking the Mina role, you know, in this, like, this is like more of a vehicle for Lucy, but it is like the traditional Mina role. But to me, these are just names, right? Like, they are, to me, like their own characters in this particular adaptation. But I love her because she's just so powerful, and like her love for her husband, her intuitive visions, and her bravery when confronted by Count Dracula himself just elevate her into a very powerful, effective hero. And I think my favorite part was like when Dracula confesses the abject pain of being without love, and he begs her to alleviate his internal suffering, and then will, like, you know, lay off Jonathan basically, and, you know, not continue to like further drain him. I love that Lucy replies easily with like the most profound quote of the film, which is, "Salvation comes from ourselves alone." Mm. Like, she's telling him, like, you can't look at me to help you. Like, that is not within my power. You are the master of your own destiny. Like, you should have, you know, you need to figure out your own shit, basically, is what she's saying, you know, where she's like bringing me into this isn't going to help you. Like, you're not going to be satisfied, you know? And that's how I took that to be, because she had gained so much like strength. And this was like when he came into her home and they're like talking like face to face. And she just straight up says, like, yeah, you're the reason why my husband is like ruined and like a shell of a man now. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, it's really lonely and painful to be immortal all these years. And there's so many things like worse than death, like eternal life without love. So why don't you like come be with me? And then I'll like lay off everybody and, you know, I'll have like you and it'll be great. And she's like, no, that's not gonna help anything. It's not gonna help you in the long run. You know? So I that's just how much I loved her. And then the fact, unfortunately, that she like dies at the end is really sad, because yes, she managed to like enthrall him long enough for him to die, but now we have a new problem. So, and that's like how it ends. And it's like, oh no.
Yeah, I was super bummed that she died. That was the one part that I was like, oh, because she like manages to hold him there long enough. And it makes sense that if you're going to do that, like he's going to drink enough blood, you're probably a goner and you're probably going to turn into a vampire. But still, I was pretty bummed. I was like, I wish she had managed to do it without dying. That would have been awesome.
Right. Or if she died, then, you know, Jonathan as well. And so they can be at least like, it, like in classical text, you know, like reunited in death or whatever.
Yeah. So is she going to become a vampire? I guess I thought she would, because I wasn't sure, but I don't know the vampire lore of this, so I wasn't clear on that.
I don't think so. No. Okay. I mean, I read the script last night, and it did not indicate that she would be a vampire.
Okay. So I guess he drank enough of her that she's just gone now, which is a shame.
Yeah. So yeah. So now we have a new problem. We have Jonathan. So
yes.
Yeah. Is he the next Dracula?
It kind of seems that way. And it was interesting because he does get that amnesia while he's ill with this vampire virus or whatever it is. So it does seem like he doesn't know who he is anymore. I mean, he definitely.
Yeah.
It's a little weird because at the end, he knows Dracula's dead. He's upset about it. I thought he was upset about Lucy, but it's not clear. And maybe he doesn't even know who she is. So it's kind of interesting to think about whether or not he still has anything of himself, or if he's just become this vampire who, you know, has already kind of lost his humanity and like the things that tied him to the human world.
Right. I mean, he knew enough because he was like, arrest him, arrest him. Mm-hmm. Renfield, he has committed murder. He, you know, he killed the, you know, the Dracula. And then like when a servant passes by, so Lucy had trapped Jonathan in his like little cushy armchair by crumbling holy wafers, like that you eat in Catholic mass. She crumbled them and sprinkled them around like in a circle so he couldn't leave and stop her from luring Dracula to their house and trapping him. So, you know, he's like, you know, you there, you know, sweep this away, you know, and so a servant sweeps it away obediently. And then he's like, ready my horse. I have things to do. But then he like, wait, I'm like, wait a minute. He's riding off in the daylight. So he's a vampire, but maybe not fully yet because.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He rode off like, I mean, this is morning. So this is, I'm like, I don't know if this is just like a continuity thing. I don't know if it's. Like he's, I don't know. Like I just don't get it. Like I was like,
we don't really see him leave the house and get on the horse. So maybe he waits till nighttime. It's not really clear because it does look kind of dark when he's riding away.
I think that's just because of the nature of where they are, you know.
Oh, maybe.
Because it's gray and, you know, these aren't because he's riding across the dunes of the beach that he and Lucy stroll on in the beginning of the film. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know like where, yeah, he's off to in the script. And I don't know if it was actually filmed. I don't remember, but in the script, Dracula sent Renfield up to Riga.
Yes. Yeah. There is a scene where he sends him up to Riga. Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't know like, oh, okay. So is he going to go find Renfield? Because he's like, you know, like the army of rats, the king of rats is coming, the plague, you know? So, mm-hmm. you know, he's trying to sweep across Europe and be like, all right. So I don't know if like, this is, I don't know. Dracula's coming to town, I guess. So
yeah.
It's very open-ended. So I'm just like, I don't. Okay.
It is. And it's unclear, like, I guess what's unclear to me is how much of his motivation is his own and how much he's sort of taken from Dracula.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. If that makes sense. So that's sort of what I was thinking, because it doesn't feel like he's motivated by anything Jonathan would have been motivated by. He's just become a vampire and now he's in this like, oh, Dracula's dead, I have to finish what he was doing or whatever.
Yeah, that actually presents then a very interesting kind of vampiric lore scenario where the original motivator of the Dracula, let's just call it strain, you know, or origin, hops from host to host. Notably in Dracula's castle, in this adaptation, there are no other vampires. Like, there are no brides. There are no, you know, there's nobody who's been turned. Like, it's just him. And from what we gather, from what he's very obviously said, is that he has been alone this whole time. You know?
Yeah. He mentions having servants, but I don't even know that we see any servants. I mean, well, we see the carriage guy, the carriage rider.
We see the Romani that he hires, and I think the Romani that he hires are just, you know, people willing to work for some coin. You know what
right.
I mean?
Oh, like, yeah, 100%.
And whether they're thralls or like Renfield, you know, Renfield's technically a servant. That could be it, really, is more than anything is like, oh, this is a servant, you know. He outsources. I think he outsources help.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I didn't get the impression that any of the people working for him were really like under his spell or wanting to be vampires or in any of that kind of situation. They were just people like he's paying to maybe sweep the floors once in a while because things are filthy or whatever.
Yeah, and cook food for Jonathan. Yeah, I was like, oh, crap, I have to have a human. What do humans like? Food.
What do humans eat? I don't know.
There's I don't know. Make you here. There, Romani person, please fetch a woman to make food for my human guest. Okay.
I'm just a regular human count and I just need someone.
I just need to know, you know, I'm just bougie. That's why I don't know how to cook. Right? Right? Yeah, wink, wink, nod, nod.
Just super rich dude is out of touch. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Live on wine and bread. I don't know.
Yeah. So speaking of servants, Renfield, what did you think?
I thought he was really good. I have said this on podcast before. I really struggle when people are very loud on shows, like when they're or jarring. Like if people are screaming at each other or yelling, I usually have to like mute it or like turn it off or like fast forward because I can't do, I don't know why, it just grates me. So like his little laugh was delightfully unhinged. Like he seemed completely absurdly out of it and just like very like, you know, he was making these little cryptid remarks and his laugh, but his laugh was so viscerally jarring for me that I really struggled with it because I'm like, this is very good acting and this is really embodying the character, but I do not want to watch this because it is making me hurt.
Yeah.
And that's I'm a me thing, 100%.
No, I mean, like, I found him, yeah, too loud for, like, the atmosphere. But, I think that's probably deliberate, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he's you know, like, he's coming. Ha-ha! Ha-ha! But his ha-ha is just very, very pointed and sharp.
Yeah.
And he's just like, ah!
Yeah, okay, to me, I felt like... I was like, oh man, this actor has like unhinged Peter Lorre kind of like I'm like, oh, he's channeling Peter Lorre like really well. So
He committed for sure. Like he went for it and it was good. It was well done. I did think it was funny because when he first appeared, I didn't realize he was Renfield. And I was like, wow, this guy's very Renfield-esque. And then he turns out that was Renfield. And I was like, oh, that's because that's him. Okay.
And I just know, like, I was like, man, if I went into work one day and my boss started acting like that, I'd be like, are you okay? I'm going to start putting my resume out.
Yeah, maybe shift that thing around a little bit. I don't know.
Right. So I don't know how you felt, but I felt Van Helsing was so ineffectual.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think with modern vampire lore, we have come to know Van Helsing as a very skilled and talented vampire slayer, vampire hunter. Like that's how he has evolved in the modern zeitgeist. And obviously that is not true in the Book of Dracula. That is not true in this movie. But I think just because of where I'm coming from, that's usually what I expect. So it was kind of interesting to see him just not really knowing what was happening. And it was Lucy who was like, oh, no, no, here's what's going on. I found this book. I found Jonathan's journals. Here's the stuff that he wrote. Here's, you know, this book and how it correlates to what's happening. I think this is vampirism, or he was attacked by a vampire. And Van Helsing is just like,
right.
Probably like just has a flu. Give him some tea.
Give him some tea. Yeah.
Put his feet up. Have him binge the Great British Baking Show. He'll feel
he'll be fine. He'll be right as rain.
Yeah, he'll be fine. And so it was kind of interesting that he really doesn't come on board until the very end. And even then, like, he slays one vampire and he's immediately arrested for it, which in itself was hilarious because all the cops are gone. All the city council's gone. So there's these two guys who I guess are running things, and they're like,
they're old.
They're old, and like Jonathan's like, you have to arrest him. He's a murderer. And the one guy's like, I can't arrest him. I don't know how to arrest him. What do you want me to do?
I'm sure like the charges didn't stick. I'm sure they were like, they walked him over to the jail. They're like, that was weird. And like, yeah. And then Van Helsing is like, we have to find that guy. That guy is now like a vampire. He's like, oh, okay. But yeah, the only Van Helsing that I really have any sort of experience with is the Bram Stoker, you know, Francis Ford Coppola one, and then the book. And so I'm not used to, like, I think Hugh Jackman, like, you know, Van Helsing, vampire slayer, you know, like action man. Mm-hmm. I'm used to him, yeah, being still like a scientist, but still having like knowledge on monsters and whatnot. So like being like a cryptid zoologist or something, you know, as a hobby. So yeah, it was very like unsettling for him to be, and I'll go in depth more into this later, but to be one of like the gaslighters of Lucy up until right the very, very end.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that, you know, Van Helsing gaslighting Lucy. And I think this is a huge theme, intentional or not, I don't know. But like, here's the thing, from the jump, like the very first scene is Lucy waking up from like this terrible nightmare. And then her husband like crawling into her bed because they have like a Lucy and Ricky kind of 1950s television show set up as far as like their bedroom goes.
Yeah, and that was actually my first note, was like, oh, they're in separate beds. That's so 70s TV, like 70s sitcom.
So he gets into bed with her and, you know, comforts her. And then when he, like, later that day is like, oh, I'm going to go off and do this. You know, she's like, oh, I don't think you should go. Like, this is so sudden and I have a really bad feeling about it. And he just like ignores her completely. Mm-hmm. And that's a continuing theme throughout the rest of the film. And then especially, I think it comes to a head once Dracula arrives in Wismar, because his terror is seen by the citizens as a sweep of the plague. And the townsfolk just give up. Like, they abandon their worldly possessions in the squares, and they completely embrace death. Like, they hold a dance macabre and a last supper in the town square. Mm-hmm. Like, they've even, like, kind of gotten rid of, like, you can see, like, there are some obvious, like, Christian iconography around. But then I noticed that, like, one of the women that Lucy talks to that's having the Last Supper, she dons a flower crown, which, you know, goes back to, like, pagan roots. So it's almost like they're abandoning the veneer of Christian goodliness, you know, and godliness, and embracing, like, their baser, more primal kind of instincts. But Lucy has tried to alert them of like the real danger, and they're just resigned to their fate that death has come for them. We're just gonna party. And like, for me as like a queer woman, this like speaks volumes for how a patriarchal society does not heed the warnings of women. And it's like a motif that stretches back into like the classics to like Cassandra, the Greek princess who was doomed by Apollo to always tell true prophecies, but never have them believed. Mm-hmm. And I know thematically that this does play into what Herzog himself was aiming for, which is the rejection of the bourgeoisie, like veneer of, you know, polite society. Jonathan didn't hear the warnings of his wife against this hasty and dangerous assignment. He was blinded by the large commission that he would garner going on this because he wanted to buy a bigger house for his wife. They don't have a need for such a house. Like, they live perfectly fine in mm-hmm. nice comfort, you know? It's just the two of them, probably a servant, and their kitties. Yes. And she, you know, otherwise is a happy, content wife. So I actually think Jonathan then becoming Dracula is almost like the curse sort of fulfilling itself, because in the pursuit of material gain, Jonathan brought doom upon himself and the whole town of Wismar and his wife.
Yeah, that didn't even occur to me, but that is really true, because he definitely doesn't need to go. They have a nice house. I mean, I'm living in that house.
Yeah,
and they definitely don't need it. And she is very much like, you know, I have a bad feeling. I don't think this is good. And then even when he's gone and she's with Mina and Mina's husband and she's having those nightmares and she's like, something's wrong. Something's happened. They're just like, oh, okay, honey, like, let's get you back.
They're like, okay, let's get you back to bed. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, but she's not wrong. Something bad has happened. And so the whole time she's very aware of like how bad this is. And she's got really good instincts. And nobody listens to her until the very end when she's already dead. Van Helsing is like, oh, I guess she was right. I better go stake the vampire. Like, that's
right.
The only time. So,
and by then, that vampiric strain or whatever it is has transferred to Jonathan, and now he's loose in the world.
Mm-hmm. And so, most of the town is dead, also. So,
yeah,
a little late. I just want to talk quickly about the cinematography of the plague thing when they're bringing out all the coffins. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was really good. Like, the way that Lucy's kind of spinning in the square and you just see like from every building, people are coming out carrying these like sleek wooden coffins and there's just a bunch of them. And it's almost like a dance the way they come out and like are moving around each other. And I just thought that was a very cool scene. So the plague is horrifying.
Yeah,
that was cool.
It's a super cool scene. And I saw behind the scenes footage of that. A British TV presenter who was like filming a kind of like a mini documentary as they were filming this. And that was the scene they were filming. So how Werner Herzog was able to get a bit more money for this production, I think it was 20th Century Fox maybe, like stepped in to like throw some money at him, but on the condition that they record the dialogue also in English. So they would film in German and then they would reshoot at the same, you know, like they're like, okay, now go rewind, go back to that. And then now say it in English, you know, so they would do that. So you saw a bit of that. And that scene was a little bit more extended, as was the town square scene. Like, she was like really, Lucy was really condemning them. She's like, you know, why are you doing this? Like, why are you stealing furniture? You know, God is, you know, going to, you know, like, this is not, you know, the reckoning. The reckoning is here. I know where it is, you know, and everyone's just ignoring her, playing, like, just ignoring her. They are completely like, I'm going to take my worldly possessions as I go down. And she's telling them, like, this is not it. Like, we can actually stop this.
Right. We can do something if we're proactive and nobody is willing.
Nobody cares. Right.
Which I got to say feels very familiar with the whole COVID situation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I hate it. It's okay.
Yeah. Thanks. I hate it. So what did you think about the Count himself, like, laying out his immortality cards to Jonathan?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting because I was like, wow, like, I guess I'm so used to vampire stories where the vampire is generally trying to disguise what they are and mm-hmm. keep that, you know, hold those cards close to their chest. And so again, I think I'm just very used to different tropes in vampire media. And then this guy comes along and he's just like, starts talking about like the weight of immortality and how hard it is to live forever. And it occurred to me later that, of course, he's not planning to let Jonathan live. So that makes sense. Like, he's not planning to let him leave, ideally, although he does leave him alive after feeding on him. So that was a choice, but it didn't seem like he was super concerned about that anyway, possibly because he already fed on him. And so whatever vampirism is in this universe had infected Jonathan. But I did think it was interesting. And I did think it was one of those things where it's like, oh yes, the sad vampire who's cursed to live forever. And there was a lot of like that angst. And then you're sitting there thinking, well, you don't have to though. But like, yeah, I don't know. I thought it was good though. It was definitely not what I expected him to do, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? What did you think of Dracula?
I thought, you know, he was presented as a much more sympathetic, even pathetic character, mm-hmm. in the sense that he was very forlorn and tired of an eternal life without love or companionship. Did I feel for him? Not especially.
Yeah.
But I thought this was very interesting. And as far as I know, this is the first film to depict him in a more pathetic light, like romantic light, you know, without there being a backstory to him other than just, here's this creature.
Right. Well, because a lot of times you get the Dracula story of like, oh, he tragically lost his wife, or, you know, he was away at war and he was forced to kill all these people and do all these horrible things, and that, you know, his soul was corrupted. And like, we don't get any of that here. It's literally just, I have been living in this castle for centuries, and we don't really know much about his backstory or what happened or how he became a vampire. I don't think we know anything really.
I've only seen the original 1922 film once, maybe twice, but even further back than I saw this. So, and I don't even think they gave Count Orlok much motivation. Yeah, there really wasn't much motivation aside from, oh, your wife has a lovely neck,
you know,
for Orlok to want Ellen, the female protagonist in original Nosferatu. And she was just, I mean, she was also clever. Like, she reads from one of like the vampire books that, yeah, a vampire can be defeated if a pure-hearted woman distracts him, and offers her blood of her own free will. So she, like, you know, sacrifices herself. But her husband is saved.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. One of the hallmarks of New German cinema is atmosphere. And this film was loaded with it, like a pinata.
Mm-hmm.
Was it effective for you? And like, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was effective. I feel like it was dark and foreboding a lot. I mean, there was that little bat climbing on the curtain, which I thought was so cute. But like, just the way that like, it seems dark, but then the castle is very white and pristine, not pristine, but white and like gleaming, and like, you know, during the daytime, but then during the nighttime, everything is very dark and candlelit, and just, I don't know, it does kind of have a gothic atmosphere and like that old school style. I don't know. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I thought it was very moody.
Yeah. Moody is a good word for it.
For, yeah, sure. Very, like, there's a lot of foreboding. I'm trying to think of, like, the furthest north I've ever been in Europe. Right below the Netherlands. I was in Bruges, Belgium.
Okay.
And, yeah, that kind of, like, gray over the canals is very, very effective when it comes to, like, paranormal suspense. Like, you just expect something to like rise from the mist or the fog that rolls off the canal, you know?
Yeah. No,
and no. I was there like at the change of the season. So it was the end of summer, fall. It was like mid September. Yeah. That I was there. So mid to late September, actually. So I was very like, oh, This is very, this has the potential to be very spooky. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel that way about forests too. And there's a lot of like, he walks through the forest and like, I don't know. I feel like that's always very creepy. And the fact that he has to like walk all the way to the castle, I was just like, I simply not walk for a real estate transaction.
Not
walk to a castle over a mountain pass.
Yeah. And I think that part was filmed in the country that was then known as Czechoslovakia, but is now Czech Republic. So yeah, you got like that really beautiful shot of those mountains too. And I've been in Czech Republic, but I've only been to Prague. So I didn't get to go into, you know, nature and see that area of the country, but absolutely still very effective. I saw that in Poland. I was in Poland and I was in the mountains in Poland. And one of our excursions was to a medieval castle.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. That it was
super cool.
So yeah, we were like tromping through the forest and like climbing up like these broken, long forgotten steps that had been, you know, they're all tilted and busted because of tree roots that have, you know, grown over the last 800 years. And this castle had been originally built, I think, in the 1200s and then struck by lightning in the 1500s, maybe even 1400s, and then forgotten about, completely forgotten about.
Oh, weird.
Uh-huh. And it was only found again, I think, after World War II, when the borders moved, because this was, you know, it goes from being like part of Germany versus Poland, depending on who's in charge. Mm-hmm. And so they found it again and they were like, oh, hey, check out this castle. Let's put a restaurant in it and charge people for some fun stuff. All right, cool. So
yeah, totally. Hey, what else are you going to do with it?
What else are you going to do? There? So yeah. So I got to climb it and everything. It was really neat. But yeah, it was very... so I felt like I had a really good grasp on also like Jonathan being trapped within the castle's grounds too, you know, like that, those kind of like weird parapets that go from one wing to the next, but then don't go anywhere because it's like the castle time forgot, you know?
Yeah, there was one point in the movie where I was like, why isn't he just walking away? Like, he's walking up and down. But then I realized, though, this is, like, still in, like, the castle walls. Like, so he's outside, but he's still, like, contained in there.
Yeah.
And then later he uses his, like, bed sheets to, like, climb out. And I was like, well, you could just walk around, but I guess maybe not, so.
No, yeah, it's not so easy. Very labyrinthine.
Mm-hmm. I just have some random notes here. So I'm just going to mention a couple things. Lucy has kittens. And like during the scene where she's like telling him, you shouldn't go, this is silly. Like she's got these, she's just playing with these kittens. And I'm like, oh my God. And of course, like I'm distracted because I love kittens. But then, when Jonathan is leaving Lucy with Mina and her husband, I was like, oh my God, where are the kittens? Who's feeding the kittens? Someone needs to be watching those cats. And then I realized they were at Jonathan and Lucy's house. So it was okay because the cats were in the house and we never see the cats again either. But this is why when cats are in stuff, I get really stressed out because I just worry about the cat. Like, Fear the Walking Dead had a cat for a while and the cat was so cool. But at the same time, every time the cat wasn't on screen, I was like, oh my God, where's the cat? Is the cat okay? Do you guys still have him? You didn't just leave him somewhere, right? And I get really worried about it. So like, I was really stressed.
Well, I'll tell you, I read the script and I was keeping an eye out for the cats because I did see your notes and there's no mention that any harm came to them. So I'm just going to assume that the servant took them back to her house. And we saw the servant at the end of the thing. So she obviously survived. So she is taking care of those cats.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah. No, yes. That is, I will believe that. There's also the scene. So when Jonathan is at the tavern in the town that's below the pass to get to Dracula's castle, he's like, you know, eating dinner or whatever. And someone asks where he's going or what his business is. And he mentions that he's going to Castle Dracula and everyone stops and stares. And it just reminded me of those old like paste salsa commercials where they'd be like, your salsa is made in New York City. And everyone just like stops and looks at you.
Oh my God. I forgot all about that. I had no idea what you, yeah. Okay. Until you like talked about, I was like, what is she talking about in her notes? To me,
exactly what I pictured. And I just started laughing so hard because everyone just like stops and like they drop their silverware and they just like are like staring at them like, oh my God, Castle Dragon. I don't know. I just thought it was really funny.
I thought of the scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where he walked into the bar and he goes, Large Marge sent me. Oh, yeah. And they're like, they all like look at him. It was 20 years ago on a night just like this, you know.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's just, and it's very well done. It's just funny. It just person struck me as like, I don't know, it's hilarious. I really like
we're jaded by like so many parodies of things like that that it's just not effective for us.
I know that's the hard part about watching older movies, and this is 79, so it's not that old, but still, like, you're just like, okay, but I have so much more cultural reference in my brain now that I just go to like an old salsa commercial from the 90s or whatever. I thought Lucy sleepwalking was really creepy. She does some sleepwalking while she's like, Jonathan is in danger. And I just thought that was really well done. And the cuts between Dracula and like her screaming Jonathan's name and Dracula being like, like he can hear it from across the distance. I thought that was really good. The scene where Dracula is telling Renfield to go on ahead. I forget what the place is called. You mentioned it earlier. Riga. Renfield is like headbutting Dracula like he's a cat, and Dracula's batting him away.
I know.
It just made me so happy.
Knowing what I know about both those actors, like, you know, and their different personalities, like, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. Just see Klaus Kinski just being like,
please stop. Just his reaction,
like, he's touching me.
He's got that claw hand, he's just like batting at him like, okay, you can, you don't have to do that. And Renfield's just like, here, I love you, master. That's very good.
Reminded me of which Renfield am I thinking of? I don't remember if like I'm conflating him with Tom Waits or the Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Oh,
Renfield. But like, yeah, like that kind of, that reminded me like of like both of those. Like, I feel like both of those actors might have taken some inspiration from this film.
Maybe, yeah. No, it was really funny. It was one of those scenes where it just made me really happy and I really loved it. So I just wanted to point that out. I did think Jonathan's amnesia was really heartbreaking. Like, Lucy's like trying to talk to him and he's just like, oh, who are you? I don't know. He just doesn't know who she is at all. And I thought that was really well done and very sad. You can tell Lucy's very just like,
yeah, she faints.
And, you know, it's, oh yeah, she does faint. She does faint the first time when they answer. Yeah, that was funny too. But then it wasn't supposed to be funny. It was just like, oh. But yeah, she's obviously very heartbroken. And that makes sense. Like, you know, who would it be? And then there's this little violinist hanging around Castle Dracula. And every time he started playing, my cat Billy, who was like sitting next to me watching us, would just like, his ears would perk up and he would look up and go, what the hell is that? So he was not a fan of the violinist. So
yes, the young man in question needed to, I think, a little bit more practice.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who played the violin, I can tell you it's very difficult, and I was never good at it either, so I would have been in doing the exact same thing. It would not have sounded great, but yep. So those are just some of my notes that we did not cover earlier. What about you? Have anything else?
You know, Werner Herzog is not somebody who's going to explain anything to an audience.
Sure.
You know, because like that was like part of that behind the scenes special. You have the interviewer who's trying to like, I don't know, suss out some motivation and things. And
sure.
Werner's just like, you know, you just have to watch, you know, my work speaks for itself. So even though like I'd be tempted to ask like about the ending, you know, and Jonathan and like the nature of vampires in this world, I know that like I wouldn't get anywhere with it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And sometimes it's one of those things where like it's probably intentionally left vague. And
oh, 100%, 100%
satisfying answer. So yeah, like,
yeah, there is no satisfying answer.
And especially when we're podcasting about stuff, you know, you're thinking about it a lot more than you do if you just watch it casually, because you know,
absolutely.
But like it does fascinate me, and I know you also are really interested in vampire lore. So it's kind of like, well, what's the deal here? Like, is there only one Dracula, and now he's the next Dracula? If Dracula hadn't died, would he have turned fully? I don't know. It's just kind of interesting.
That's another thing, right? Yeah. Well, in the daylight too. I think that I would like to know, and I feel like there might be an answer there, which is like he hasn't fully turned, like, you know, like this is like his last day in the daylight.
Right. And then
which does happen a lot in vampire lore, various vampire lore, where you get like one last day and then you transform. But yeah, I'd like to see the German version if I can ever get my hands on it, just because I know Herzog prefers that version.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's worth hunting down and finding. And then otherwise, I know that a lot of people who are fans of the, I guess you could say, the Nosferatu universe, they like to watch first the 1922 silent film, then this one, and then Shadow of a Vampire.
Okay. And Shadow of a Vampire is the one that's like kind of meta, and it's just about the movie, right?
It's so it is about the making of Nosferatu, the original.
Okay.
And but John Malkovich, who plays Max Schreck, who played Count Orlok, is actually supposed to be a vampire.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I don't think I've actually seen that. I remember when it came out and I remember the trailers. I don't think I ever watched
it. I saw it once before it came out because I saw it before it came out
nice.
Because I live in Los Angeles and sometimes there are perks to living in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So, and growing up here and such. So that, but that is literally the last time I saw it. So I would love to see it again because I think I was 18 when it came out.
I think it'd be really interesting just because, and John Malkovich is always so...
He's very good.
He's very good. He's very interesting. So that could be, it's probably very good.
Yeah. So I think that would be a good follow-up eventually to...
Yeah, for sure.
To watch this. And I know that we'll one day do the 1922 film. There's just a lot. There's so much to talk about that film that isn't the film itself.
Right.
Like it's all the pre-production and all the shit that happened afterwards, all the copyright info, all the litigation that happened, the bannings of it, you know, like in places like Sweden. Like it's, you know, it's
just a whole
it's a
mess.
Lot. And for us now, audience listeners, just dipping our toe back in, I was like, there's no way I have the fortitude to jump into Nosferatu.
Yeah, so, I know. This is the first episode we're recording in, like, I don't know, 9 months or something. We really, I don't know what happened.
At least.
Actually, I do know. I knew some of what happened, but, like, it's just,
yeah,
a lot of that was my fault. But
no, there's no fault. Life happens.
Life happens.
There's no fault.
You know,
we're making free content on the internet. People can as long as they want for free. I know
I
do. I
just really want to be that person. Like, there's a guy whose podcast I've been listening to. I've been mentioning it to you and Nick a little bit because he podcasts about The Walking Dead. And, like, I've been watching The Walking Dead because I got back into it. I don't know. I got sucked into the zombie void. It happens sometimes. And, but he just, like, as I'm listening through his episodes, like, because obviously he started when the show was new and, like, I've been going through, like, he quit his job to podcast. He has, like, 4 podcasts. He, like, does all this work. And I'm just like, man, I used to have that kind of ambition. And now I'm just like, I'll get to it. I'll get to it.
Right. Yeah. Same. You know.
I got, like, a full-time job. I have cats. I have family stuff. Like, I don't necessarily, you know, it's like I love doing it, but it's like I'm not ever, this is never gonna be my full-time job. I'm not gonna drop everything and make 5 podcasts a week so that I can quit my job. Although that would be very cool. Maybe if I ever win the lotto and can just independently do whatever the hell I want, that will happen. But until then, it's not likely. So
right.
We did it. Whoa, go
we
us.
We did it.
You're welcome, listeners, if you're out there. If you still exist in any form.
If you are still subscribed to us, thank you so much.
We appreciate
you.
Yeah, we exist. We still want to talk about vampires. It'll
happen. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Always talk about vampires with us. We're totally here for that. So I will tell you this. Tori, I've been saving this story, like this little tidbit for you. So my friend is getting, like, deciding to save some money and just get rid of, like, a few of the streaming services that they no longer really watch.
I need to do that really badly right now.
And she was like, she goes, oh, but once season 2 of Interview with the Vampire drops, I do want to, like, get a free trial so that way I can just binge it for a week. And I go, and I just looked at her in horror and I go, oh my God. Season 2 hasn't even happened.
I know.
I was like, God. I was like, I don't know that Tori and I have the strength to go on.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean,
I feel like there are other people out there who can do that recap much better justice. than us.
Probably, yeah.
Because I think we're just too... We're too close ingrained.
To the books.
Yeah, and we're too close to the material. Like, it's very hard to say objective.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, I know I keep bringing up The Walking Dead, but, like, there are comics that those are based on. And so it's funny when you listen to people talk about the differences, and there are huge differences. Like,
there are huge differences. I did read some of the comics, and I stopped because they got too gruesome for me. But, I was like, I can't do this.
And just the way they treat different characters, the way they give another character's story to a totally different character. And it's just really interesting to hear people talk about that and be like, okay, like, but I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if season two, I feel like I'm less angry. I feel like I was really upset last time. And I don't know where that all comes from, but I think it's just because I was too close to the books and I was too upset about the changes they were making, and I wasn't willing to, like, I did try to look at it beyond that as its own thing, and I didn't really love it as its own thing either, but I think I'm just too close to it, and all I can do is be like, that's not what he would never say that.
Like, right.
He would never do that. And so it's just really hard for me to see it as a separate entity because of.
Yeah, it is its own thing. And I think I did an okay job separating it, but, like, I didn't like the thing in the end. You know, it's like, look, I acknowledge
either.
Yeah. I acknowledge that this can be its own thing. It absolutely can be its own
100%.
Thing. Look at Star Trek and stuff and the Kelvinverse and everything like that, you know? But I go, but here's the thing. I don't like the thing that you have given me.
Well, that's how I feel about the Abrams Star Trek. Like, yes, it is Star Trek. I get why people like those movies.
Yeah, the Kelvinverse, yeah.
Yes, and I get it. For me, I hate them with a fiery passion. They don't feel like Star Trek to me. And so, like, I can't... I respect people who like them. I don't think that means you're not a real Star Trek fan or anything. I think you can absolutely love them. They just, for me, they don't do it. They don't give me what I want out of Star Trek. And I feel like maybe that's how the Interview with the Vampire show is. Like, it's, I don't hate it with a fiery passion. I can laugh at the memes. I think there's a lot of funny stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I totally get why people are into it. I have a lot of friends who love the books and the show, and they're super into it, and that's cool. But for me, it just doesn't give me what I want out of that series.
Right.
So, like, it just isn't doing it for me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was also the same for, what was it? Let the Right One In, the TV show that was so stupidly not Let the Right One In.
Right. Like, and it's like, that's fine if you can love it as its own thing, but if it's not giving you what you want out of that story, then, like, what's the point?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And, right. And I, like, right. Because I basically had to ask myself when we were watching Interview with the Vampire was, if this was its own universe, and it is, but, like, with completely different names, would I still be interested in this? And by the end of season one, I could say definitively, no, I really wouldn't be into this.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of vampire shows on TV, and, like, some of them I'm into, some of them I'm like, meh, you know, I'd probably watch it, but it's not.
Right.
No one wants to hear me cry about, like, how they've changed too much. Like, you know, it's not what I would want it to be. And that's fine. I'm not the target audience for that. So.
Right. That's the thing. I'm also like in a stage in my life. I'm middle age where I can go, this was not made for me. And that's okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think, like, a lot of people our age also need to, like, find that peace within themselves. You know, it's like, there are things that are just not going to be made to target you. And if you happen to like that thing, that's great. But if you don't, just know that you are not the target audience. So it's not there to please you.
I think that's true for everyone. I think the world is a better place. If people could just look at a piece of media and go, nope, that's not for me, and move on with their lives instead of trying to condemn it morally or find reasons why people who like it are terrible or whatever it is that people do on the internet these days.
Well, even to the opposite effect, I mean, this is so far away from vampires now, but I'm the example I'm about to give. But My Little Pony, the G4, the Friendship is Magic, you know, one. And it's like, if adults liked it, which they did in droves, that's great. But it's really actually not meant for you, you know?
Exactly.
It's still for children. It's just that you have some winks and nods to the older stuff that the parents or the adult fans, you know, might appreciate. But at the end of the day, you are not the target demographic for this, you know? And that's okay. Like, I made peace with that, you know, and other media. Yeah. So I feel for us, for our own mental well-being, we're just going to say no.
Yeah, we're probably AMC not going to cover Interview the Vampire. Interview with the Vampire season 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I end up watching it, which I haven't decided, I may just do like a little mini thing. Maybe I'll tell you about it or something. But I don't think we're going to do like episode by episode because I just don't. Plus that it's coming out in May, which is both my birthday month and work is probably going to be crazy busy for me. So I'm not going to have time to like sit there.
Right.
Pump out an episode a week as it's coming out. Cause I definitely will be like, there's no way I'll have too much going on. So, but yeah, so that's, I guess, our way of saying sorry about that. If you're looking forward to that.
No, I think it's important that we should tell them that, you know, that we should tell our audience that like, if you were looking forward to that, it's just not going to happen. And if it does, it is going to be like a mini-sode.
Right. It'll be a short little thing. We probably will cover some Vampire Chronicles stuff at some point. I do want to
Absolutely.
Vampire movie. I really do love that movie. And again, that's not a perfect adaptation either.
No, not at all.
Where I'm like, but you know what? It works for me overall. I think it's very good. And then there's just, you know, and you know, I love those books. So I'm sure we'll talk about them at some point.
Content. Tori, at the end of March in just, let's see, what day is it? It's the 10th? In 2 weeks.
It is the 10th.
Yeah. I will be in New Orleans for the very first time.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. So once we get done here, I might pick your brain.
Awesome. So, yeah, I know I've been there a couple times. It's great.
I'm very excited and I am definitely going to be with my friend and we're going to dress like vampires and go take pictures in a cemetery.
Oh, that's so fun. That's so we're
like, cool. I'm like, bring your vampire teeth, bitch. We're going to New Orleans.
Oh, that's awesome.
So. Well, thank you so much, listeners, for sticking with us, for listening in. And please let us know your thoughts on Nosferatu the Vampire or any other Nosferatu-related media and keep the conversation going.
And if there are vampire things you'd like us to talk about, feel free to offer those suggestions. We will take them. And we may or may not do them, but I'm happy to hear what people would love to hear us talk about. So,
yeah, that's how we got the mini-sode of Let the Right One In, because somebody hit us up on Instagram and asked us our opinion for the TV show.
Yeah.
Spoiler, our opinion was not high. I think it was my opinion because, so. You didn't watch it. You're like, no, I don't got time for that. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I do. All right, listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in. And then we have
an outro that we'll play. Yeah, we've got one. Yeah.
All right, cool.
This is Tori and Chell wishing you a fantabulous evening with vampire wishes and batty nightmares.
This podcast was edited by me, Tori. Our music is edited and mixed by Vikra the Never Living and includes Dark Halloween Night by Chase Allen Willis and Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Kevin MacLeod.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you really want to join our hellish crusade, please leave us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Be sure to tell your favorite blood-sucking fiends about Vampires Ruined My Life.